This is the BBC.
Chinese characters. Historian Rana Mitter tells the story of China in 20 remarkable lives. Part 9. Patriotic poet.
The surface of Venus. You'll find plenty of impact craters there, but only one named after this poet.
Up in the heavens, the river of stars tosses and turns. And here in the mortal realm, my curtain drapes droop. A chill springs from my pillow and bedmat as the tear trails upon them lengthen. Rising, I loosen my silken nightrobe. How advanced is the night? Tiny are the lotus seeds nestled in emerald. Sparse the lotus leaves flecked with gold. The same old weather and the same old robe. My heart alone is not as it once was.
An ode to love, quite appropriate for the poet being commemorated on a planet named after the goddess of love. But this writer didn't live in classical Greece or Rome. She lived in medieval China. Li Qingzhao, known to this day as one of China's greatest poets. But why is she so well known today? In part, it's because of the quality of her verse and her status as a prominent female poet. But there's another reason that's not so immediately obvious. Confucius, our previous Chinese character, did a huge amount to crystallize the ethics, the ideas of what it meant to show loyalty to your family, to your superiors, to your country. From early on, patriotism was a strong part of being Chinese. And Li Qingzhao's poetry burst through with a powerful sense of affinity for all that defined that country. The landscape, of course, but also less tangible values, ethics, and priorities central to the cultural notion of Chineseness. This wasn't modern nationalism. There was no sense in medieval China of a shared citizen body or nation-state. But Li Qingzhao lived during times of peace and then war, and as a result, her attachment to the country and the culture that had nurtured her burned throughout her life. Li Qingzhao was born in 1084 during the Song Dynasty to a family of scholars in Shandong Province in northern China. Being a woman didn't prevent her from gaining a deep knowledge of the Chinese classics. She was well able to debate ideas from the philosophical canon, as well as identify obscure-seeming classical quotations. But she didn't just learn, she wrote as well, becoming a deft poet whose works were widely recognised. In 1101, she married Zhao Mingcheng, the son of the Grand Councillor, essentially China's Prime Minister. Their lives then followed the paths of rising bureaucrats of the time, the up-and-coming official and his wife. Zhao and Li were reported to be a devoted couple, and they were also devoted to art. Learning poetry and practicing calligraphy were part of the repertoire of civilized life at the time, and archaeology and epigraphy, the study of ancient inscriptions, were at the cutting edge of scholarship in medieval China, rather as 19th century England saw a huge interest in exploring the deep past.
Whenever we'd finished dinner, we would sit in our hall, named Returning Home, and brew tea. We'd point to a pile of books and, choosing an event, try to say in which book, which chapter, which page, and which line it was recorded. The winner of our little contest got to drink tea first. Oh, how I wished we could have got old living like that.
So far, so civilised. A successful career for the husband, a wonderful collection of art and books for the couple. But Li Qingzhao's life was one of two very distinct halves. In 1127, disaster struck. There are a lot of factors that have stimulated China's development of a shared identity. Language, ethics, religion. But one of them, paradoxically, is the fact that its history is a history of refugees. Not all of it, not all of the time, but more than the often-heard narrative of a long and stable civilization might make you believe. The 20th century saw millions of people forced to flee their homes in the face of civil war or invasion by Japan. But that wasn't the first time it had happened. In the middle of the 12th century, the entire Song dynasty fled south, and with it went Li Qingzhao and her husband. The problem was the Song's difficult relationship with the Jurchen, the ethnic group across the border whose dynasty was known as the Jin. By 1127, the Jin struck at the weakened Song dynasty, invading its territory and putting the court to flight. Zhao Mingcheng sent his wife away with their literary and artistic collection, ordering her to live or die with them. In Confucian terms, an order from a husband that a wife had to obey. In 1129, a terrified Li Qingzhao heard that her husband had fallen desperately ill. She rushed across a war-torn country to be by his side, but he had deteriorated too far. He managed to wield his calligraphy brush once more to write a final poem, and then he died. Now Li really was alone. She had no husband, no children, no means of support, and somehow had to transport a collection of 20,000 books and numerous artefacts through a land in turmoil. She sent most of them to her brother-in-law, but the Jin then attacked the city where he served, and most of her belongings went up in smoke. She eventually made her way south to the city of Hangzhou, where the Song had re-established a capital. Even here she wasn't safe. Crooked landlords reduced her once magnificent collection to one or two random volumes. Then a whiff of scandal circulated around her. A junior official proposed marriage. We don't entirely know why. It may be that he thought that her art collection was rather bigger than it was, or more valuable. Not so much gold digging as calligraphy scratching, perhaps. Li agreed to the marriage, but soon seems to have realised it was a mistake, and she was stuck with someone determined to make her life pretty miserable. And divorcing a husband was no easy thing in medieval China. You might remember that our first Chinese character, Emperor Wu Zetian, was accused of taking the easy route and just murdering hers, admittedly in slightly different circumstances. Li took the less radical step of denouncing her husband to the government for lying his way into a position in the civil bureaucracy. And it worked. He was convicted, and she was granted a divorce. But the whole affair left her reputation indelibly soiled. She came close to being prosecuted herself. Dobbing your husband in, even if justified, violated the norms that tied Confucian societies together. The divorce opened up the path to her final and perhaps most powerful shift in her writing. You could call it the move from ethereal poet to tabloid polemicist. Well, maybe not quite that. But she was venting political anger of a pretty virulent kind.
The driving rain does not abate. The wind increases. Carriage wheels creak and horses whinny sadly. Men of valour and cowards are both reduced to tears. A widow of the inner apartments, what do I know? I write this in blood to submit to the imperial archive.
And her reason for doing that was, once again, that nexus of patriotism and loyalty to the Confucian system that shaped her identity, even though she had herself suffered from that system. The Song dynasty was slowly but steadily weakening. In panic, it was sending peace envoys to the Jin from its crumbling position in Hangzhou, and Li Qingzhao made it clear that she hated the idea, lambasting the regime for bowing down to the foreign invaders. It might seem odd that she was least constrained in her writing in the last years of her life, when she ought to have been a highly respectable Confucian widow. But she was a childless woman whose reputation had been shot by divorcing her husband in scandalous circumstances. In medieval China, losing your reputation could be a kind of freedom in itself. Li no longer had to worry about what society said about her. So she was free to concentrate on what mattered to her most. Overall, she must have been driven by the memory of loss. In her earlier life, she was deeply embedded in Confucian social norms and bureaucratic court culture of the highest sort. But her poetry in exile implies that she didn't know at the time how much she'd valued it, and how precious it seemed after she had lost her home. Her writings on the value of the Chinese state and the culture that underpins it are a fierce incantation of loyalty to something deeply under threat.
All we want is fresh tidings of our homeland. Do our abandoned subjects still plant mulberry and hemp? Do the routed barbarians guard the city walls? This widow's father and grandfather were born in the northeast. Their descendant crossed the river south years ago to drift aimlessly now as a refugee. Take my blood-stained tears to those hills and rivers and sprinkle them on a clod of East Mountain soil.
We keep coming up against that paradox. The sense of loss and the fear of collapse have, for some Chinese, fueled ever stronger feelings of attachment to their country. Confucius himself had worked on his philosophy and ideas of ethics and loyalty as he wandered from one state to another in the conflict-ridden China of the 5th century BC. And you might remember that Ding Ling's intellectual odyssey around Chinese feminism came as part of her literal long march across the war-torn country of the 20th century. When Li Qingzhao died in 1155, she seemed to have lost most of what she'd acquired during her life. But in the centuries that followed, her reputation as passionate, patriotic, and above all, poetic, means that she has outlived her contemporaries. And beyond that, her fame is now literally out of this world. Our next Chinese character isn't a person, it's a product of lots of people. A television series, one of the most watched in the history of the medium. And it could be an answer to the challenge, the revolution will not be televised. Well, they thought, maybe it just might be.